So this month we are going to begin our journey into the Paramis with generosity. And every time I hear or read that original sutta verse, I remember the first time I heard that. And I thought to myself, there has got to be something else connected to generosity besides the word dana, the way we do dana. It's not that I don't think dana is generosity, but I've been given dana for 25 years, and I still don't think I'm at this level of giving my last mouthful of food to someone else. You know, there's something else that's connected to dana, that's connected to generosity, besides just this idea of the way we practice dana here in the West. And so I'm hoping that I can talk this month on that level of generosity, so that you don't think that this is just some extended dana talk, that it actually is a talk on generosity and what that is. The way I think I'll lay it out is, we'll have one talk tonight, and we're going to talk about the nature of generosity, what I think, from what I've read and practiced, what I think that nature is of generosity. And then next week we'll have a discussion on that. And if you know me, I just don't like the fact that we come and do another talk, we do a second week on discussion, and it's just a rehash of the first talk. I'm more like Rodney. Who knows what the next week's talk will be? It'll be some kind of extension of this talking about the nature of dana. But it will, I mean, the nature of generosity, but it will not be just a rehash of whatever we talk about today. And then in the third week from now, we will do another talk, and that talk will be on practices, this practical application of generosity, some of what we're going to talk about tonight, and then we'll do a discussion night on that in the fourth week. So I want to start with this quote from Tanisaro Bhikkhu, his book, Refuge, Introduction to Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha. He said that the Buddha did not begin his teachings with the concept of suffering and the end of suffering, which is kind of strange because that's what brought me to the Dhamma. That's the first thing I heard, was that Buddha taught the suffering and the ending of suffering. But Buddha didn't actually begin his teachings on this concept. He ended his teachings on this concept. He began with discourses on generosity, joy, and the rewards of practice. And after beginning with the joys of generosity, then Buddha would describe the joys of a virtuous life followed by the rewards of generosity and virtue. And then, only then, when he sensed that the listeners were inclined to look favorably on renunciation as a way to true happiness, he would discuss the central teachings, the central message of his teachings, which was the Four Noble Truths. So in some respects, the way we practice in the West, we can kind of see why it's difficult for us to deal with all the obsessive suffering that we go through all the time, because we start looking into our suffering and how to end that. We start with this idea that, oh, I'm suffering. Like many of you, you may have come to the practice because there was so much suffering going on. So that's why I came, because I'm trying to end all that. So we come into this practice by way of suffering. And then generosity, or even the idea of generosity, is kind of an after effect. Sort of that generosity is what is going to show up once I get rid of all this suffering. Then I'm going to be generous and happy, and all the good things are going to come. Just got to get past the suffering level first. But that is backwards. When we practice and you read and you begin to see how practice actually works, it's backwards. That you start and find generosity and the joy in generosity first. You start there, you build on that. And the nature of suffering, you begin to understand it, and then when you begin to understand it, then you can see the causes and the cessation of that understanding. But we start with a generosity, a generous nature. So that's what I'd like to talk about. It's like, how do we get to this generous nature? I'm going to divide it up into three ways. So first, when I started reading about this and looking into it, I thought, okay, I want something more than Donna, but I had no idea how overwhelming some of the information is about generosity. Given the way that we kind of do a little Dhamma talk at the end, it's sort of way, way bigger than that. And so not to, it can get pretty complicated and pretty overwhelming trying to explain all the little nuances in the nature of generosity. So I thought I would break it down into three aspects. And I'm going to talk about the three aspects tonight. And we'll talk about them a little bit more next week, and then we'll talk about how to practice with these three aspects. So the first is that the nature of being generous is learning how to let go. The nature of it is learning how to let go. We talk a lot about letting go in practice, and we're trying to let go of suffering, but we don't really talk a lot about the intersection between generosity and this nature of letting go. So we have this kind of common statement that, you know, you hear a lot in practice, that if we let go of a little, then we get a little liberation. If we let go of a lot, we get a lot of liberation. And if we let go completely, then we get complete liberation. So when we sit and we try to practice, our whole practice seems to be around this idea of just letting go, letting go, letting go, letting go, letting go. But I can see now, having this much more expanded way of looking at life, this expanded heart that I live out of mostly now, I can see how that idea of letting go just wasn't, why it didn't work when I first started practicing. The very thing I wanted to let go of, I rarely was able to let go of it. So even when I was sitting and trying to think and let go of thoughts, I couldn't let go of them. I just seemed to be caught in this restricted nature of the way thinking is. So a way to begin to look at this idea of letting go when we're trying to let go is that it's like trying to tell yourself when you're tense to relax. The more you try to force yourself to relax, the more tense you get, because you're tense. That's why you're not relaxed. And if you were relaxed, you wouldn't be tense. You see? So there's this kind of circular argument we're telling ourselves to let go of something. And the only reason why we want to let go of it is because there's so much attachment to it, and we think there's so much value in it. It's like we have thoughts when we're meditating, we want to let go of those thoughts, but we think those thoughts are important. So we're trying to tell the mind to let go of something that we don't think we should let go of. So you can see how this idea of trying to practice with letting go doesn't actually help us let go of anything. But generosity and letting go are tied together. They're interconnected with each other. So I don't know, we don't talk much about this one monk named Ajahn Lee. And Ajahn Lee was a Thai forest monk, very famous. I think he lived back in the, practiced in the, I know the 40s and 50s, but I'm not sure when he died. But Ajahn Lee wrote an article for, well, I guess he gave talks, and then Thanissaro Bhikkhu translated it as an article to teach people who were beginners, you're starting out in practice, how to practice. And he said you start with generosity, and you start with this idea of understanding the link between letting go and generosity. He explained that there are three different levels of generosity. First level being dana, second level being kaja, so C-A-G-A, kaja, and the third level being upadhi, U-P-A-D-H-I. Okay, so that first, I never heard of those three words. I've heard of dana, but it's not just dana. It's dana, kada, upadhi. So I'm going to take each one of these three and talk a little bit about this, but these three are all under the idea of seeing how to let go, to see the intersection between being generous and letting go. Instead of practicing letting go, we consider practicing being generous. The first one, dana, is connected to this idea that we give away material things. I forgot one other thing. I didn't write a note here, so I have to think here. But the generousness of what we're doing, we're giving away three gifts. We're giving away three gifts. Those gifts are material things, the gift of fearlessness, and the gift of the Dhamma. So next, the next talk, we're going to talk about how to practice with those three gifts. But I just want to explain the nature of them as I see it tonight. So we start with dana. Dana is this practice of giving away the material things in our lives. It's not easy to give away things that we acquire, because once we acquire them, they become ours. And this acquisition and accumulation of property creates this sense of protection and safety for us. The more stuff we have, the more things we gather, the safer we feel, the more we feel protected, like I could take care of myself if I need something. So it puts us, this acquisition of things puts us in a place of strength, creates this way that we have rights over our stuff, and it puts us in a place that we are part of a larger group, a belongingness that comes from our acquisition. Buddha is looking at this accumulation of stuff is not the same as the way we look at our accumulation of stuff. So Shantideva, he wrote the big thick book about a guide of a bodhisattva's way of life. He says, others are my main concern. So when I notice something of mine, I steal it and give it away to others. You know, I steal from myself and give it to someone else. It's because at the same time this accumulation of stuff gives us a sense of strength and protection, a sense of thinking that we have acquired wealth, it also creates a lot of danger. It creates danger for ourselves in trying to keep it. It creates danger in others, for what we do to protect ourselves from others being able to steal it or take it from us, creates this kind of possessiveness. So I'm going to talk about the nature of it tonight, but we are not monastics. And so when I started looking into this, I tried to think, I mean, most of the stuff I read about, come from people who were either monastic at one time or they're monastics. But there's a way to practice around our stuff that does not have to bring the level of harm that it brings both to ourselves and others. That practicing is what we're going to talk about next time. But tonight, it's just the idea of beginning to notice our attachments around the stuff that we have all around us. Sometimes when I think about the way I live now versus the way I used to live, it's quite remarkable. Because I grew up in the projects. I grew up in High Point in West Seattle. Before High Point looked very nice like it does now. But I grew up there and didn't have any grass. So it's a little different now. It's kind of fancy. But I can remember walking to school. I went to Fairmont Park, the elementary school there, and I would walk past these beautiful houses. So from my perspective in life, this little girl, all I could think about was the acquisition of a big house. That was it. Acquisition of a big house. And as soon as I got a big house, I would know I had made it. That's what it seemed to be all about. So as I went through school, went through law school, I mean, the whole point of law school was to make enough money to get a big house. And I can remember at one point when I got out of law school, I had set in my mind that I had made it, so I need to have a big house. And I went to law school in Kansas, at Lawrence, Kansas, University of Kansas. So I went to Kansas City, Missouri to live. And you know, they have big Victorian houses in the inner city. And so I looked and found me this gigantic house that was, somebody owned it, but they just had a lot of stuff in it and nobody was really using it. And I convinced this property owner to let me move into this house because it was big and I needed a big house. So the guy still had all his stuff in this house. It was more of his stuff in there than my stuff. But I still stayed there. And eventually I began to hear these little sounds, like little feet running across all over the house. And I realized that this house was full of all these mice, because no one had been in it forever. And I can remember the level of disappointment because I had to give up this big house that I had. It was like I was taking a step back and to give up my big house. I thought about that when I was doing this writing because I live in a tiny studio now. I live in a space that feels very big to me, but it is nothing like I thought I would need in order to acquire things. It's not so much that I think that the studio is somehow better than this big house and that having the big house was a bad thing. It's that it was in the acquisition that I would be willing to take and grab after anything that would help me get what I wanted. And now it's less about getting the acquisition and just where it is that I happen to be living. It's less about that. Ajahn Amaro gave a talk one time. Well, actually, let me just move to the second one before I get too lost. The second one is Kaja. And Kaja, it has to do with our giving up our rights of possession. That's what this is. The first one, we give up our stuff. We give up things. It's our willingness to let go of material things, things that we have. That's dana. Money, possessions, you know, clothes, food, it doesn't matter. We give up the material things. But the second kaja level of generosity is that we learn to give up our rights to possess things. It's the possession of the things that we begin to give up, that idea. So I wanted to share this story about Ajahn Amaro gave this talk one time in Inquiry Mind, an interview. And I guess the monastery where he lives is beautiful. It's in England, but I've never been there. I've never seen it. I've never even seen pictures of it, but I hear that it's beautiful. And so the interviewer, Ajahn Amaro, was talking all about renunciation and giving up and the monk's life and all the stuff that they give up. And then the interview, I think in a kind, it seemed kind of snarky, said something like, you know, well, you know, the place that you're living at is pretty spectacular. It's pretty beautiful and, you know, whatever words he used to describe it. And Ajahn Amaro said, yeah, it is. You know, it's very, very beautiful. It's very nice. And he could appreciate, he talked about how much it was very nice and very different than living in a hut in a Thai forest. And then he said that, but it's this knowing that it's not yours that makes all the difference in the world. It's not so much that you have to give up whatever good that you have, but you begin to practice with this understanding that it's not mine, it's the ownership in it that's a problem. Buddha said, to live a pure, unselfish life, one must count nothing as one's own in the midst of abundance. It's not that we give up stuff or not have stuff, but that we begin to see that some of the difficulty comes with the possessiveness of it, the ownership of it. So we are beginning to let go, not so much of our stuff, which is in dana, with kaja, we're beginning to let go of this acquired nature of ownership in the heart. You begin to let go of the need to own something. And at this level, it seems like generosity is much more connected to developing a dispassion in relation to things. So you have things and you're connected to things, but there's a dispassion in the nature of having those things. The last step in this kind of three-part way of giving is in upadhi. And upadhi is in the practice of giving up the acquisition-type defilements that are in the mind. This would be what Ajahn Lee said was the highest level of giving. So you're practicing letting go of the underlying causes of craving and ignorance. I think that the kaja is related to the gift of fearlessness, because once you give up that possessiveness of stuff, then people don't have to worry about you causing harm to them about your stuff. You give up that possessiveness about it. And then this upadhi is connected to that gift of the Dhamma. We learn how to look for and unhook ourselves from the underlying causes of craving and clinging. And we do that by investigating the nature of attachment and how that attachment arises, gives rise to the craving, and gives rise to the clinging. This is a much subtler way of practicing generosity. Joseph Goldstein said, the value of an action is measured not by its success or failure, but by the motivation behind it. in this sort of level of generosity, we are much more concerned with what is going on behind our giving and less about the giving itself. It's almost like we treat generosity in one sense, one way, a giving. We don't notice necessarily that part of the giving, the receiving, and what's going on in the whole act. We treat generosity not so much from what's happening to us, but what's happening, but just the idea that we're giving something. And when you're practicing with generosity, you are looking at both that giving, the receiving, and what's going on internally and externally when you do that. Which goes to the second aspect of generosity, this nature of being generous. Besides the letting go, you know, it's actually the letting go of whatever it is that you have. Besides that practice of letting go, the nature of being generous seems to be connected to this natural flow of giving and receiving. Deepak Chopra said that the universe operates through dynamic exchange. Giving and receiving are different aspects of the flow of energy in the universe. And in our willingness to give that which we keep the abundance of the universe circulating in our lives. So what we then practice is this giving and receiving. So here is another place where the writings around generosity is so, it's so much about it. It's on this giving and receiving. Now, so far I've said, we're going to break this down into three aspects. We're on the second aspect. The first aspect was broken down into three levels, Dana, the Kaja, and the Upadi. And now, in the second of the aspects, there are six factors. You see what I'm saying? It's getting a little complicated here. I know you're all trying to sit there like, I'm going to hold this all in my mind so I can have a good flow. So I'm trying to see, how am I going to keep this otherwise extremely large body of information both interesting and simple? So in the second aspect of learning to be generous, first aspect, learning to let go, or the intersection between letting go and being generous. Second aspect is connecting to this idea of giving and receiving. So when we give, this idea that giving is a one-sided thing is not what Buddha's talking about in the verse I read at the end of the sit. The giver, there are three factors. One is happiness, one is inspiration, and one is gratification. So the giver must be giving a gift that's freely given, must be freely given and not out of a sense of obligation. I can remember when I first started giving dana, it was a little miserly, I must admit. I put a few little dollars in there. Just a little, kind of give. I never had a sense that I had to give. So I just gave whatever I happened to have in my pocket. But after I had kind of an awakening and Rodney and I begin to see each other more regularly, my idea of giving dramatically changed. It dramatically changed in connection to this expansive understanding of the Dhamma. So in this giving, I was so inspired by Rodney, and my need to give was more connected to that inspiration than it was to how much I gave or what was the appropriate amount. It's connected to this idea that the receiver has to be free of passion, so free of this idea that how much are you giving? How much are people going to give me? What am I going to get? That is not easy, I can tell you. And free of aversion, this expectation that there has to be something given. And lastly, free of delusion, that you're not paying attention to that energy. For teachers, it is very difficult. I can tell you, I have an immense amount of respect for teachers who've been practicing in this way for a long, long time, because you are, especially teachers who give up their livelihood in order to be with the Dhamma and live in the Dhamma, you don't want to lean into gifts that are given to you. You don't want to create a don't give me anything. And you don't want to be irritated or angry if what you got wasn't what you expected. So this is it's just this holding of all of this. But in reality, I mean, I can see that as a teacher living off of Dhamma, but in reality, I think what the Buddha is pointing to is that is the way that we all live all the time. We are constantly giving, and we consider, do we give from this happy, inspired place, this free giving of whatever things I have, whatever possessiveness I have, and that ignorance of watching our clinging. So when we give, whatever we're giving, whatever generosity we are trying to extend in life, is that generosity coming from a place of happiness that is inspired and that it's connected to this larger sense of gratification in life? And likewise, the giver or the receiver comes in this place that's not full of passion, aversion, and delusion. On top of that, the receiver presents this kind of way that they are trustworthy in whatever gift you're giving. And that sort of responsibility that the giver takes, the responsibility the receiver takes, together it creates this kind of inspiration. So Tenasaro Bhikkhu wrote this article about coming back from Asia, having practiced in Asia for a long time, and then he came to the States, or not the States, but he came to the West. And he was a little disappointed in the way the West was practicing Dhamma. It was so kind of bland and so, you know, haphazardly tossed out there towards the end of the sit, that it was always about how much you were going to give and what kind of money you should give and the level of that giving and all of that. And he was disappointed because in Asia, in the monasteries, not all monasteries, but in the monasteries where he had been at, this giving and receiving was thought more of as the nature of interaction between peoples. So it is a necessary thing that we all kind of give and receive from each other, to each other. There's an awareness that we're all giving to each other and receiving from each other all at the same time. Chung-Yung Trumpa, he said that you have to be fully involved. You have to become one with what you are doing. So it is with this giving things away, no matter how small the thing is in terms of value, one must be fully involved in the giving, so that a part of one's ego is also given away. Through that, one reaches the paramita, the paramis, the transcendental act of generosity, which is something beyond the ordinary. But what that means is, all those years I used to just toss a few dollars in the Donna basket, I thought of that as, oh, I'm generous. I'm being generous, I'm doing my Donna, doing generosity, the kind of the way we talk about it. But Rodney used to say over and over and over, do not just toss money in that Donna basket. Have a relationship with it. That is something that we miss in the nature of generosity, is having a relationship with our giving. It's not what we give. It's the relationship that we have to the giving. So you have to watch yourself and see, am I really inspired in the way that I'm doing this giving? Am I happy? Is it freely given? Or does there seem to be some kind of obligatory thing? And when people give to us, even if it's like a compliment, I have a hard time with people saying, oh, that was a great talk tour. And I'm like, oh yeah, I know, I wish I could take credit, but I can't. But really, it's such a dismissive way of someone who's trying to share some gift that was given to them by some talk that I did. Even though I may not want to accept that, it's still a gift that's being given to me. And so we begin to pay attention to the gifts that people are giving us. Okay, this is the last part. It is the nature of being generous, then, is both an internal and an external practice. It's not just this external practice of giving. So we practice around giving externally by giving whatever is needed to whomever stands in need of it. That's a pretty big thing there. Giving whatever is needed to whomever is needed. And if we see a need, we give whether asked or not. We're just giving, 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 giving. We give generously, sufficiently, and evenly, whatever we can share. And we give appropriately. So we give whatever, in the case of monastics, you give to lay people what lay people need, and you give to monastics what monastics need. Internally, we give without malice, ill intent, begrudgingly or haphazardly, and we give without expecting something in return. So the nature of this idea of being generous, it is not just what we give and how much we give. It's paying attention in our practice to that intersection between our giving and what's arising within us and what's arising outside of us. Generosity is something more than just giving. It's more than just dana. Joseph Goldstein said that if we try to practice meditation without the foundation of goodwill to ourselves and others, that goodwill I'm thinking of as generosity. If we try to practice meditation without the foundation of generosity, It's like trying to row across a river without first untying the boat. Our efforts, no matter how strenuous, will not bear any fruit. In some respects, I think that coming into this new year, coming into a place where we begin to practice and begin to look at the nature of generosity in our lives, this is the perfect place to start. It doesn't mean that we're going to go home and try to figure out how can I get rid of everything so I can be a better practitioner, because that is the nature of the way we think about generosity, as just in the giving away. But you can practice giving away just by simply noticing the attachment you have at the thought of giving something away. You can look at all the furniture in your house and imagine that somebody came in while we were sitting at Sims and took it all out of there. So what would you do? What would happen? What would arise in that moment? Would you be able to recognize that the stuff was never yours in the first place? It was always going to leave you. It's not possible for us to hold on to anything. So at some point, it was always going to leave. Maybe it left a little earlier than you thought. The idea of beginning to practice with generosity is to begin to practice outside of just this idea of I'm not going to be stingy and I'm going to give away more stuff. You just want to practice with the understanding of where you are in the nature of generosity. I can't believe it. I actually finished on time. So I haven't talked about the nature of generosity. You see how big it is, how luminous this idea of generosity is. So I'd like to end by reading Buddha's words again, from a different concept of dana, but this idea of just how large and non-ordinary generosity could actually be. If beings knew, as I know, the results of sharing, giving and sharing, they would not eat without having given, nor would the stain of selfishness overcome their minds. Even if it were their last bite, their last mouthful, they would not eat without having shared if there was someone to receive the gift. But because beings do not know, as I know, the results of giving and sharing, they eat without having given, and the stain of selfishness overcomes their mind. So let's sit a few minutes. So we'll take questions for just a few minutes, if there are any. You can't untangle it from your feet. Mm-hmm. Oh, I see. So I think the comment or the question is, she can't untangle this idea of losing everything and this fear that she won't have everything she needs, right? So there's like, if I lose everything, then something bad, I guess, is going to happen. And I think that is the reason why we start with generosity, because it is a mental thing that's going on. The possessiveness, the idea, this craving or clinging to things as a sense of protection is a mental thing. It's not a reality. It's in the mind. So that place right there where you feel that fear around what would become of me if I were to lose everything, that is the place of practice. That is the place of practicing with generosity. It's not the actual giving away things. It's not the actual having to have some major thing happen where you lose everything. You don't need to actually lose everything. You just need to have the capacity to pull that possibility up in the mind and sit with the fear of it. Just be able to touch into the fear of it and see what's behind that. Because it's not just a fear. There is a distortion behind that those things is providing a sense of safety or providing a sense of ease in life. But in reality, the idea of having to hold on to them causes more stress than if I didn't have it at all, you know. So that's what you're looking at. The practice is not so much in whether you're able to let go of everything and get rid of all your stuff, but can you just practice with the fear that arises at the idea of losing all your stuff? See? Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And this, because that is this topic. I think, you know, on one hand, it's in many ways very radically different from the values of our culture.
It is very much so. So the comment was if I can kind of talk a little bit about being able to practice where you're at with whatever this topic is, because the nature of the way Buddha talked about generosity is so different than the way culturally we live, which is, again, that is the whole point of starting with generosity, starting here where you're at. And I think in some respects, the first thing is to begin, I think that's why the reflections and the practices that I have for the week or the next 2 weeks is to begin to notice where you're attached. That's it. Just notice at the very smallest. It's not, I can't give my last mouthful away. Because I can sit here and say, I can't get my last mouthful away either. You know, I can't do that either. But it is recognizing that place of where the tension is between this idea of an expanded sense of generosity and my current place. That's where practice is. Practice isn't in the trying to make ourselves be in some other place as much as it is. Can you just practice with the part of you that can't move or doesn't want to move from the place you're at right now. So if the idea, think of this, let's say you think, I just don't have any money to give in Dana. I just can't do it. I just don't have, it's too tight. Then your practice isn't so much about making yourself give money in Dana, but it is in practicing with that constriction around the holding of money in life. It's not so much around how much you give, but can you even let yourself have some ease around the idea that you don't have any money? It could be that you have money, but I can't give any time. I can't show up for a practice here. I mean, I can't show up for all these volunteer things because I just don't have any time. Then the idea would be to see where that constriction is around time. I mean, some of this we're going to talk about in the next talk, so that you can see how to practice to both sort of resonate where you're at, and then how to stretch a little bit so that you can get into generosity and this idea of being generous in a much bigger context than just what you give away and what you don't give away. See? So most of this we'll talk about in the next talk. Did you have a question? Yeah. That's great.
And after doing that, like, we just heard, like, that there's not a limit. Like, I think it generosity can be interpreted as, like, I lose something and then they gain something.
Yes.
Well, actually, there's an infinite amount for all of us to, like, you know, be good or whatever.
Yes. So if I can try to see if I can get this, is that you're, and for the beginning, you were practicing with generosity of giving rid of things, but you're beginning to see that generosity is also connected to this idea of who's right, who's wrong, like in an argument or something like that, or getting your way. And you can see that generosity can be a practice of where you see these infinite numbers of ways that things can happen. It can be a right, a wrong. Both of us are right, both of us are wrong, neither of us are right, neither of us are wrong. You know, there's an infinite way that we can relate to one another. That's also part of what we're going to talk about in practice next time. But you're right, there's a sense that after a while, this much more, if we apply this nature of generosity, as even with the possessiveness of kaja, then we don't possess our own thoughts. We don't grasp around our own thinking. We don't grasp around our own ideas, our own opinions, our own ways. All of that is a sense of possessiveness. And that possessiveness shows up then in the way we relate to other people. It can be quite a generous thing just to give someone the gift of being right. I mean, I don't think of it as a gift when you're going to let someone be right. But for someone like me, who's a lawyer, we're always right. You all know that now. So that is a huge gift to give someone, for me to let go of my possessiveness, my ownership around some idea or some way of being. Or doing the work that I do to untangle myself from that, the ignorance connected to clinging and greed, all of that is connected to my need to be right. So once I start doing that work, then even the idea of letting someone be right becomes a natural part of the way we live, and not something that I have to make myself do. So if there's one more, we'll take one more, otherwise. Actually, I want to share a story. It's so cute. It's a sense of how I, it's a way to learn a little bit about generosity. My oldest boy, when he was about 2 years old, we didn't have a lot of money. And so I bought this box of macaroni and cheese. That's all I had. So I cooked the box up. And I gave him a little saucer that you'd put a cup of your cup on. And I had the big plate. And I had all the macaroni and cheese on my plate. And he had his little saucer. And I put a couple of kernels on his plate and slid it over there to him. And so we were sitting on the floor at this time. And he finished those couple of kernels, sent his plate back to me. And I put a couple of more kernels on his plate and sent it back. He sent his plate back, and I'm still eating. So he is tapping my plate. So I thought, okay, I'll get a scoop, and I put a scoop on there. And he decided that the scoop was not enough. So he began to eat from my plate with his hands. At first, I remember feeling this kind of, no, that's mine. This is yours. This is mine. I remember feeling that. But he kind of looked at me with macaroni and cheese all over his face, and he's looking at me with this sense of, you know, we could both eat from the same plate. And I can remember feeling that expandedness of realizing it didn't have to be his plate, my plate. And we kind of sat here, took turns eating this plate. That's where we're going with this. It's beginning to see that it's not my stuff, your stuff. That there's a way that we're all interconnected with all this stuff. And that we all are sort of relating to each other, learning to relate to each other without things like boundaries and rules and lines that separate us. Not in an unhealthy kind of codependent way, but much more in a sense that we are all giving and receiving and intertwined with each other. So we'll leave it there. Thank you kindly.